When Europeans arrived in the Americas in the late 15th century, they sparked perhaps the most dramatic ecological and cultural exchange in human history. Nowhere is that fact more evident than on our dinner plates, and we are kicking off a new 8-part series today called Globivores, Food Travels Around the World Since 1492, where we will look at the profound changes that the Columbian Exchange brought to cooking and cuisine. And our first installment is all about the tomato and its 500-year journey around the world. Joining us are Andrew Smith, culinary historian, author of The Tomato in America, and chef Lydia Bastianich returns our show. She's an expert on all things Italian. Her latest cookbook from Knopf is called Lydia's Favorite Recipes. And there's, by the way, for you, our listeners, still time to submit your favorite tomato recipe on our show page at WNYC.org. Lydia and Andrew, welcome to our show. And Lydia, when you're selecting tomatoes, are there certain characteristics that you look for?
Oh, my God, you opened here such a wide... Yes, yes, I look for the species, the season, the preparation that I want to do with them. I want to eat it raw. Do I want to eat it cooked? Do I want the intensity of a tomato paste? Yes, there's so many ways to choose a tomato.
Are you more likely to look for tomatoes that have taken on a distinctly Italian character, like plum tomatoes, than the heirlooms that we've been seeing
They have different strengths, in the kitchen. Certainly, if you talk about the Semarzano, the plum tomato, that's great for making sauces and cooking. That's great for canning. It is delicious bought in cans and doesn't necessarily, everybody says fresh, fresh, fresh. But the plum tomato in can is a wonderful product. Now, if I want some nice buffalo mozzarella and fresh, I look for the fresh, whether it's a beefsteak or cuore di bue, or one of those ripe tomatoes, but still with the tint of green. I like my salad tomato with a tint of green.
And the tomato, a tomato like a beefsteak or an heirloom with a little bit of olive oil, some mozzarella, a slice of basil leaf, and some sea salt. It has to be one of the greatest things.
Absolutely. You see, the tomato has all the elements. It has acidity, it has sugar, it has sweetness, and it has that sort of vegetal kind of flavor that it brings to the table. So all you need is a little olive oil and the salt to sort of accent it all, and you've got it.
Well, Andrew, since you're a food historian, are you more likely to like heirloom tomatoes? Do we have any idea what the tomato looked like in Mesoamerica?
Yes, and it's available in your local store. It's called the cherry tomato.
Oh, really?
The cherry tomato is the original tomato. And you can find wild tomato varieties in the Andes that are very similar to that.
Well, as a backyard gardener, I find cherry tomatoes very easy to grow, easier than other kinds of tomatoes.
They grow faster, yes. And they taste better in some ways because they have a lot more sugar in them, typically, anyway.
Where in Mesoamerica did they originate?
Well, most likely in the coastal areas of Peru and Ecuador. But there's no evidence that anybody in South America actually ever ate a tomato prior to the arrival of the Spanish. They happened to be domesticated in Central America. So it's one of those strange things of plant originating one place and being domesticated someplace else.
Same with chilies.
Well, chilies, there is evidence that chilies were consumed in South America prior to the Spanish conquest.
But we know of them and tomatoes from Mesoamericans.
Yes, of course. That's where the Europeans first ran into them is in Mexico with Cortez.
And how soon did they start taking them back to
Europe? Very quickly. Despite all the normal fake lore that appears in historical works, the tomato went into Italy. The first recipe, 1542, is Italian. I just want you to know that, Lydia.
All right.
And numerous recipes appeared after that. So it was regularly there. It wasn't a common food in most of Italy. It was a food of southern Italy, and it was a food of the poor, so it didn't really make it into most of the haute cuisine cookbooks.
And it remains a food of southern Italy, doesn't it?
It does, because it first came through the Spaniards. The Spaniards occupied the southern part of Italy, so it was brought in. And the climactic conditions are very conducive to a ripe, nice tomato.
Anybody can grow a tomato in southern Italy. All you have to do is plant a seed, and 3 months later you have a fruit, and that's great.
But were the Spaniards embracing it themselves? Or were they just simply looking to sell it to other people like the people who they had so much control over.
Have evidence of tomatoes in Spain in the 16th century. So unlike the stories that, you know, tomatoes weren't a part of European cuisine for hundreds of years, the fact is that they were there. They just weren't part of haute cuisine. They weren't part of the upper class.
Well, I've heard that stories that people shunned them because of their color, and then they thought they were poisonous because they're part of the nightshade
family. Those are all nice stories.
But the leaves are.
The leaves. I mean, I've eaten the leaves, and I can get sick, but I wouldn't encourage anybody to do it. But they do. They do have solanine in them, and it's not good to eat. But the tomatoes themselves were consumed from the beginning, and there's no evidence that anybody in America ever thought the tomato was poisonous. There are some European herbals that have that statement in there, but I'm not even sure what plant they were referring to.
Still, the Spaniards were bringing all sorts of things back from the Americas, and some were embraced here, some embraced there. Tomato in southern Italy as much as any place, potatoes elsewhere, chilies, vanilla, chocolate.
Sweet potatoes. It's an amazing story, and it's one of which I've been fascinated with for 30 years. So it's what got me into writing about food history in the first place.
Now, the tomato yields so much fruit, and like the tomato, like the corn, all these new vegetables brought into Italy, certainly, you know, when the commoner needed food for the family, the tomato responded, the corn responded, and they became a big part of the food of the table.
Did they change? Did the soil and the agricultural practices change the tomato in Italy?
Absolutely. I mean, just like wine, the tomato, the fruit itself, is very reflective of the terroir. And I think the amount of sun and the amount of water, it's all, you know, because it's a fruit. It takes it in. If it's too much water, it's too watery. It's less concentrated. So absolutely, it reacts like other fruits.
And we should point out that it is a fruit.
It is a fruit. According to the Supreme Court said it was a vegetable, but botanically it is a fruit.
Now, tomatoes have a similar name to tomatillas, which are very different. Are they related at all?
They have no botanical relationships whatsoever, but they do have an historical relationship that both the tomatillo, or green husk tomato, and the tomato were grown and consumed in Mexico when Cortez came in. And the word for tomato actually was jitomatl. The Aztec word is, or Nahuatl word is jitomatl. And the Spaniards mixed them up and called them both tomatoes. And so you have this confusion. Those of us that try to look back historically and look at what people were actually talking about until they describe it, you don't really know for sure.
Lydia, we pointed out that tomatoes are particularly important to southern Italian cuisine. Why do you think Italians in Sicily and in the south of Italy embraced it so completely while you go further north and you hardly ever see a tomato?
Well, because of the climactic condition, but the tomato, when it's, you know, ripe and perfect, it's the perfect food. You know, it has the right acidity, the sweetness, and it has a lot of pulp, especially if you're cooking it. And the pulp of the tomato is a carrier for other flavors, whether you put garlic, whether you put basil, whether you cook some meat in it. So economically, you know, it stretches the flavors of other elements. And, you know, southern Italy and their pasta. I mean, pasta was in Naples eaten white, just like street food.
Without tomatoes, how can that happen? You can't do that.
Naked pasta.
It was. And once the tomato came in, it just overtook that whole realm of dressing pasta. And that was a big winning step in the Italian cuisine.
You know, Andrew, did similar things happen in other parts of Europe or in Asia?
In Spain, it did happen that way. And, of course, the tomato also goes to Africa, and it was adopted there very quickly because of the climatic conditions are very similar to Central America, and it grew very well there. How it arrived in the United States is still an open question. Most likely the Spanish brought it in, but it could well have also come in through the slave trade, or it well could have come in through early Italian immigrants. We think of Italian immigrants as only arriving in the 19th century, but there were Italian immigrants here in the 18th century, and they brought tomatoes with them.
Back to the countries of origin that
well, brought to the United States. There was no tomatoes in the United States.
I'm talking about South America also. They brought them to South America.
Yes, that's correct. So they did take the tomatoes from Mexico and Central America into South America, and so you have virtually all of the languages of South America using the word tomate as the one for tomato.
Well, the Columbian Exchange also involved Asia, and Asia embraced certain things like chilies, but Not tomatoes until fairly recently.
Well, that's a surprise, too, because the first evidence for the tomato in China is also 16th century. So relatively quickly, it entered the Mediterranean, went to Turkey, was adopted in Turkey and Bulgaria, and then from Turkey through the Spice Road went into northern China, and we do have records of it there. And today, China, the People's Republic of China is one of the largest producers of tomatoes in the world. So they have adopted it en masse in the last 20 years.
But mostly for export.
Partly for export to Italy, where it's canned in Italy and then sent to the United States as a product of Italy. So they have these interesting relationships. But it is also part of the cuisine in southern China, too.
My guests are Andrew Smith, who's a culinary historian. One of his books is The Tomato in America. Lydia Bastanich, how many cookbooks have you written by yourself or in?
This is my eighth.
Wow. This one written with your daughter.
Yes.
Is called Lydia's Favorite Recipes. And your cookbooks have covered both authentic Italian food and Italian-American food. The tomato is even more important to Italian-American food.
Absolutely. That's why the Italian-American food is different than food in Italy because of the products, because the tomatoes that were found here were not the same. They were more like a salad and very watery tomato with a lot of seeds, and the sauce needed to cook much longer. So, yes, it made a difference in the cuisine itself when the immigrants came here.
So you can't substitute an heirloom tomato classic red sauce?
No. They have, you know, there's the perfect tomato for the great sauce, like there's everything else. And what you're looking for in a tomato for a great sauce is in plum tomatoes and in Samarzano, and that is thin skin, lots of pulp, and very few seeds. Seeds are tannin, make the sauce bitter, so you don't want too many. You don't want too much juice, too much acidity you don't want in the sauce.
Now, what about sun-dried tomatoes, which in this country may be eaten all year round, but in Italy are eaten in the wintertime?
That has become a sort of a specialty now, sun-dried tomatoes under oil. But traditionally, in the South, what they did is that when winter would sort of come, the fall, they would take clusters of tomatoes on their vine and nails in the cantina, and they wouldn't hang them, and they would slowly dehydrate as they would use them for winter food. And so what became evident was that, you know, they had this delicious concentrated flavor because they were dehydrating in the cantina. And dried tomatoes sort of had a real purpose, and then they became a delicacy.
But do they serve the same purpose that canned tomatoes do?
It's different.
In the cold weather?
It gives you different results. You know, canned tomato has so much more water and a different approach of cooking. In a dry tomato, you have the concentration, so you have to maximize that. You don't have the pulp and the other. So, you know, they both bring somewhat the tomato flavor, but you have to sort of cook it differently.
Now, tomatoes go incredibly well with olive oil.
So oh, they do.
This is part of the Columbian Exchange in another way, because olive oil came from Europe to the Americas.
Indeed, the oil of North America was lard, simply because olive oil was so expensive. Olive trees did not grow well in America early on, and so they had to import it all from Italy. And it isn't until California comes online and the olive oil industry takes off there that you begin to have American olive oil. And even today, not that much. It's mainly from Italy.
Or Spain.
Or Spain,
yeah. Or Greece in some cases. But since tomatoes were already there in the Americas.
Historically, no olive oil.
I understand. But how was it used in Aztec or Mayan cooking? Do we know?
It was made into salsa. I mean, this sounds bizarre, but what you think of as Mexican salsa is, in fact, pretty much what it would have been prior to the time that the Europeans arrived. So it would be the combination of red tomatoes and chili peppers and whatever other ingredients that you wanted mixed up, and it would be added as a sauce.
And it's still being served that way in Mexico, but because of the Columbian Exchange, I'm assuming that fusion cooking is occurring in Mexico using some of the European approaches, Italian approaches, just as I think there are salsas in Italy, aren't there?
Salsa and sugo are names that are used for tomato sauce. It's quite different than what you relate to salsa here. So sugo is more an intense meat-flavored tomato sauce. Salsa is a more lighter tomato-based, only with some garlic and oil. So it sort of delineates the two different tomato sauces, not as salsa would be here with chopped fresh tomatoes,
yes, chopped
with peppers. But, you know, each culture has its kind of a triad in the beginning of the kitchen. So the Italians are tomatoes and onions and garlic and oil. The Spanish, I guess the Mexicans, are pepper, tomatoes, and I think onions as well. So the cuisines have their sort of holy triads, if you will, when you begin cooking.
A listener wonders why some Italian-Americans call tomato sauce gravy.
But that's the salsa sugo. That's gravy usually would be related to sugo, which has some meat cooking in it and gives it more complexity, whereas tomato sauce is the lighter version without the meat.
My grandparents were Southern-born, and they always called it gravy. So it's also a regionalism in the United States.
Yeah.
We have posted one of the recipes from your book on our show page, spaghetti with pesto trapanese.
Yes.
You're incorporating the tomatoes into a pesto sauce?
Absolutely. That's from
trapani. Should we say pesto sauce? Is that redundant?
Pesto. No. Pesto is pestare, to chop. So it applies to anything that's the sort of the Ligurian took it as their own, but this is from Trapani, Sicily, and they use almonds. You see, almonds are a source of protein, so almonds, fresh tomatoes, some garlic, some oil, some basil, some parsley, and they used to, in the mortar, chop it and dress pasta with it.
Well, nuts were used as thickeners in Europe before other things came along that also thickened. In fact, wasn't Italian cuisine before the tomato and some of the other ingredients that came from other parts of the world, wasn't it largely ground nuts as a base?
No, it had a whole series of different types of foods. Again, depending on where you were in Italy, because different foods, even in the north and the south prior to the Columbian Exchange, and it depended on how wealthy you were. So if you were poor, it's whatever you could grow in your local area, and that was it. And so it's grain-based.
It is. We are, you know, I come from Friuli, so we're polentoni. Again, a new world.
That's very north.
Yeah, but a new world product, and it just took over because it was so it yielded so much and it fed the people. But yeah, up north we have chestnuts, we have walnuts, almonds somewhat, but Sicily is known for their almonds and pistachios, so you would see more of that into their cooking, into their pesto, into their desserts.
Now, Andrew, you said that the tomato actually wound up coming back to the Americas with European immigrants.
Most likely, yeah.
I understand that the pilgrims brought turkeys with them because they thought they were a European bird.
They did. I mean, the turkey went very quickly from Mexico into the Caribbean, from the Caribbean into Spain, and it was very quickly adopted in Europe, and it was served at Christmas tables in England in 1550. So by the time the pilgrims came over, they looked around and saw all these wild turkeys running around and said, wow, we know what those are. Those are turkeys. And so then they imported domestic turkeys.
Well, again, Sicily probably adopted more of the American products than any other part of Europe. I've heard of a turkey and chocolate sauce being a festival dish.
Well, because it was right on the crossway of all the trades and exchanges.
And so Spain controlled it.
Yeah, Spain, then all of Middle East and North of Africa coming into that area. There's, even pasta, dry pasta, claims to have come from the Middle East. I mean, you know better than I do, certainly, Andrew.
Yeah, well, we have the first pasta recipe, believe it or not, is from England. But the bizarre thing is
that... You're going to give credit to the English
now?
No,
not at all. But
the English love tomatoes.
They didn't early on. So, the pasta is a fascinating story in itself, and most likely it came from Italy, but the first written recipe is in a manuscript, and it happens to be
you
English.
What I read was that the nomads of North Africa, they made their sort of sheets of pasta, and they would dry it on the stones. And as they moved on, they would carry these dry sheets. And then when they would settle, when they would put a pot of boiling water and crack this dry sheet of pasta into it. And that was kind of the birth of Itria, or pasta, as it's called.
It could be. There's also lots of evidence that the Romans did something similar to that, too. So it's very unclear.
They just weren't using wheat. Came from China. Well, that concept, no? Because isn't the story that Marco Polo brought back pasta?
Yeah, that's not true.
That's not true.
That's a nice story.
Back me up, Andrew.
I back you up, Lydia.
Well, that's for another show. But thank you both so much for participating in the first of this Globivore series, Food Travels Around the World Since 1492. We've been talking about the tomato with Lydia Matijo-Bastianich, her latest book, Lydia's Favorite Recipes, and also Andrew Smith, who's also written the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.